Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook.
It's Wednesday, October 30th. From HBR2, it's The Conversation. The Governor's Awards cap Hawaii Fashion Month tonight. This morning, we'll get the perspective from the head of Hawaii's creative division. And it's that time again. Political analyst Neil Milner is back with the long view.
Which might also be the distance covered by many performers next week. And we'll take a trip to the third annual Fringe Festival. And we'll get a lesson in kalo culture, the movie.
First, a look at today's headlines.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook, and good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, Chris.
I wonder how many people have a more jaundiced view of their government than they did, say, a couple of months ago.
Well, a couple of months ago, well, that's not much time. You know, maybe 50 years ago, but a jaundiced look and a very long forgettery and knowing how to move things, you know, into an argument that's not just a month or a year or even a decade long, but others. And tomorrow we're asking, or not tomorrow, but today we're asking a question. In politics, how can you win by doing absolutely nothing? Well, it depends on how you define winning and the length of your horizon, which, according to political analyst Neil Milner, is exactly why we're stuck in the present gridlock and why for 60 years those big losers probably include you and me. Neil Milner joins us now for our biweekly segment, The Long View. Gridlock, you know, we're talking about the fact that not much really, really happens, and it's not a matter of just a policy or one-off, but overall the kind of gridlock and its impact, right?
Right, yeah. Gridlock, doing nothing has great consequences, and one of the most important consequences, according to recent research, which covers almost the entire period from 1940 on in national government, is that the more gridlock there is, that is, the more filibustering there is, the less ability to pass laws, the greater the degree of income inequality. That the amount of gridlock explains an exceptionally large amount of the increase in income inequality in the United States.
And we're talking about income inequality, meaning transference of wealth?
Transfers, the amount of income that the 1% gets. Right now, that's about 25% of the income, the total income in the country. 1% has 25% of the income. That's the highest since right before the Depression. And that has a lot to do, much more than people think generally, with gridlock. So gridlock has consequences, and the consequences are that it increases the amount of income inequality.
And this is not just simply about talking of the debt ceiling or talking about keeping the government going, but this is pervasive.
This is pervasive, yes, but much of the gridlock now is very explicitly related to income issues like the debt ceiling, like the refusal to raise revenues, like the fight over cutting the budget, and do you have to cut out programs and so on. So right now you're in a period where you see this kind of relationship between gridlock and inequality playing out very explicitly.
But you're also talking about issues of taxation in there too, because
yes,
that's been the big bugaboo and what no one really wants to talk about except to say no, no, no.
Well, that's right. I mean, what you have right now is very much in the tradition in the Republican Party of the very strong anti-tax movements that have been in the United States for a long time. They ebb and flow in terms of how successful they are. But the Tea Party is very much in the tradition of the kind of anti-income tax things. A recent study, Republican focus groups, when they talked, and they find that within the Republican Party, the Tea Party stands out in two things from the rest of the Republicans, in its emphasis on liberty rather than equality, and on its support for the 1%, for its belief that you shouldn't increase taxes on the 1%, and that, in fact, the job creators in the world are the 1%. So what you have now is this kind of anti-tax sentiment that's been around for a long time that has done a very good job of capturing much of the Republican Party. No more taxes has become a very binding pledge for a long time. So you see how this inequality and gridlock thing are all coming together right now.
In terms of taxing the 1%, we hear this term, you know, the fair share, and who should pay a fair share. Fair to whom and fair to what?
Well, that depends on your point of view. Again, looking at the Tea Party is not made up of rich people as a rule. They're made up of predominantly white, sort of on the older side, folks who are reasonably well off, but believe that the 1%, believe that those people deserve the wealth they get. And from their point of view, not only do they deserve it, but they're the ones who will save the economy.
Because they're the rainmakers.
Because they're the rainmakers.
They're going to be the job creators, and they should get the buy when it comes to taxes.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's certainly no agreement on whether this degree of inequality is a problem. What's interesting to me is how much we've talked about inequality in a way, income inequality in a way that says it's those big forces out there that we can't control. And what the research suggests is that government can control a chunk of it, but that there are big differences over whether we should or not, and whether it's a problem that we have this kind of thing.
Which sounds like this is not going to be anything that's going to change anytime soon, despite all the conversation about next year's election and the one in presidential election in 2016.
No, I don't think it's going to change very soon for a couple of reasons. First of all, the power that the safe districts and the institutional rules that allow for inertia is going to continue. The Tea Party passion, I don't care that right now there's less approval for the Tea Party. The kind of passion that they bring to politics is very powerful and will continue. Long run, and even in the 2014, you may see some of this change because it's hard to keep anti-tax sentiment together unless there's a very compelling issue of a policy threat. And it's not clear. Obamacare was pretty much off the table as a policy threat. Now it's back on, but it's still already there. But when the real challenge for anti-tax people, particularly in the Republican Party, is going to be the first time is going to be in 2016 in the presidential race, because the American electorate is pretty stable. And the American electorate doesn't buy in as a rule to one compelling issue as a mandate. So the challenge for the really passionate anti-tax people, the Tea Party people in 2016, is to be able to get a candidate across that appeals to a broader base, because that's what you need. And that's the classic fight in every political party, but certainly much more so in the Republican Party. The Romney versus the right is going to play out in 2016, and that's the ultimate challenge for the Tea Party. And remember, the Tea Party is a movement in many ways. They think like movement people, even though they've been successful in influencing the Republican Party, and compromise is very hard for them.
But when he comes back to the whole issue of the impact of gridlock long term, and this is obviously, yeah, we're just now looking at the two-year horizon, although this may be a Republican and Tea Party issue or driver this time around, it's not always been that way.
That's
but
right.
The issue of that pervasive issue of gridlock and the inertia that's gone over decades has been at times Democratic, it's
absolutely
been at times Republican. This time we're just focusing on that because that's where it happens.
That's
to
where
lie.
It happens now. Remember,
but the bottom line is that we've had, you know, 60, 70 years of inertia and gridlock.
Yes. And remember, gridlock is built into the American political system as a healthy thing, the separation of powers and so on. What's happened, though, is that it's become that, and in fact, that may increase the income inequality. What's happened right now is how much focus there is on distrust of raising revenue.
All right. We'll talk more about this in a couple of weeks. Thanks for coming back.
You're welcome.
Political analyst Neil Milner is the contributing editor of our new biweekly segment, The Long View, and he'll be back in a couple of weeks for the next installment of The Conversation.
Support for today's programming comes from UH Manoa Arts and Minds, presenting a lecture by Thomas Lawson, artist, writer, and dean of the School of Arts at the California Institute of the Arts, 1 week from today, Wednesday, November 6th, at 6 p.m. in the UH Art Auditorium.
In films and books, Americans are fascinated by the myths of medieval England.
We don't have castles that are 800 years old. And so we kind of hold on to what we think are these old ideas of heroism and chivalry.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason, Thursdays at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15. Later in the show, a different gridlock, the electrical connection of Oahu and Maui. But now, turn off the lights. Here comes the quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, Oahu. Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholawe, uhawaiti.
Tomorrow is Halloween, so we thought we'd get you prepared for the mischief with a quiz from Hawaii's haunted backyard. For many, the Pali Lookout on Oahu is associated with the paranormal, and whether or not you believe in this type of spiritual energy, you have to admit the history of the Pali is colored with the macabre. Over 200 years ago, the site of the modern-day Pali Lookout marked the end of the Battle of Nu'uanu, and that battle was the last major conflict before the conquest of Oahu and the unification of the Hawaiian Islands under the rule of King Kamehameha. It concluded with the death of about 300 Oahu warriors who were forced to choose between dying in combat and jumping from the cliffs of the Pali. For today's quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us the month and year this event occurred. And if you're lost in the dark on this one, we'll have the answer in the next half hour.
Hi, good morning. I'm Joe Moore. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about our show at hpr2.org.
Some performing arts are difficult to categorize, and often that's good. If what you're doing is easy to pigeonhole, that could mean it's because everybody's doing it. The Oahu Fringe Festival, now in its third year, includes belly dance, puppetry, theater, improv, dance, cabaret, spoken word, and aerial art. And if some of that is a bit unfamiliar, so much the better. Misa Tupou is the organizer of next week's event, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Misa.
Good morning. Thank you.
You kind of shop for art out at the fringe, don't you, to put this festival together?
Yes, I do. I made a call out to everybody. The Fringe Festival is open to anybody and in any art form, performing arts.
Just the fact that you're not sitting in judgment makes it a different kind of event, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. You don't want to be telling artists, hey, I don't think your artwork is fantastic. No. We want to elevate their art form. We want to be able to say, hey, you know what, this is a platform for you and we want you to shine on it. So it's open to emerging or established artists, basically anybody, but the art form has to be performing arts.
Well, given that performing arts and all arts are sort of inherently subjective, doing the whole game of good, better, best is problematical anyway, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it can be very, very destroying to one's soul.
Yeah.
If somebody says, you know what, I don't think your art form is that
You're just
fantastic.
No good.
Exactly. And you don't want to say to somebody, nope.
Yeah.
You want to be able to give them some encouragement.
Well, I have to think that most of the artists that I've known have at some point been told to just forget about it, you know, early on.
Yeah,
and they didn't.
And what happens to them?
Well, I mean, I have to wonder how many people drop off the boat at that point and feel that maybe something is lost.
Well, the fringe is all about elevating one's soul. So
yeah.
That's what we want to do.
So you're working against that whole process.
Exactly. I mean, just quickly, the whole Fringe Festival concept started in Scotland.
Right.
Because a group of artists heard that they were not invited to the international festival. So they said, okay,
We're
going to do our own festival.
A local art, Hawaii artists.
Yes. Uh-huh. And we have a few artists coming from out of town. But basically, anybody is involved is accepted, as I said. Yeah.
But it started with, it's interesting that it started with people who were not invited, right?
I know. Isn't that great? So if somebody tells you, oh, you cannot do this, what do? We go ahead and do it.
Well, and then you have to think about, and we talked a little bit about this when we first met this morning, is that how many artists met with disapproval when they started and are now considered completely mainstream artists.
Exactly. I grew up in New Zealand, and I saw Flight of the Conchords perform in New Zealand doing a lot of theater stuff. Mm-hmm. And, well, those two went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, the original, and that was it. Now they've become mainstream.
They got discovered.
Exactly. But they had already, prior to that, they have already done a lot of work in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So you do need a platform to be discovered. And the Fringe is a great platform.
Well, and I think you also, to be worth being discovered, you've got to do a lot of work. I mean, that's the key there. You said, all the overnight successes who've been at it for 20 years.
Yes, you cannot just turn them and say, hey, I'm it. There's a lot of work that has to be done prior to being successful.
Yeah. Do you find that the artists that do succeed with the audience at the Fringe Festival, are they do that correlate to the hardest working ones?
Exactly, and I've seen that. They go out there, hand out flyers, they talk to people, they even stop people on the street and tell them what their show's about. You have to be able to do the groundwork. Because without that, it's not going to work.
Well, these are the things that a lot of artists think somebody's going to do for them, right? While they remain in splendid isolation doing their their work.
Yeah, you cannot just sit there and say, oh, somebody's going to find me. No, they're going to find you if you stand up on a platform and say, hey, this is what I've got to show you. And you cannot just sit at home thinking, oh, when am I going to be discovered?
No.
You got to go out there and show everybody what you got. Yeah.
You mentioned platforms, and there are a great many, you know, from one year to the next, there are more ways to get your work out there, more platforms, and a whole different language that's being spoken, the whole social media language. Do you see artists adapting to that?
Oh, yes. Let's see. Being on a stage production as opposed to being on a film production and doing something out there on the social media like YouTube, they're all good tools to use. And you as an artist need that exposure. So if you work in all those mediums, it's going to help you immensely. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to just limit yourself to one, okay? You have to be able to explore those different platforms. I keep using that word.
Oh, that's it's the word.
Yeah, because if you don't explore those platforms, how are you going to improve? And what the Fringe does, because it's so welcoming, there's no failure, so to speak, because it's all about you. Oh, that's what I like. When you're on that platform, it's all about you. So you got to show the folks, the audiences, what you have. And regardless of whatever platform you use, you got to give it your all.
It gets to the very kind of mindset that makes an artist. And in a way, an artist has to be very focused on self.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, the biggest believer, you have to be kind of your own biggest fan, don't you think?
Yes. You have to be, because as you know, Chris, sometimes we critique ourselves so much.
To the point of self-destruction.
Destruction, yes. And that's not what we want.
Yeah.
So we want to be able to share what we have with an audience, because sharing is so important.
Well, yeah, because for a performer, you can only rehearse for so long.
Yeah,
right?
and then you get to the stage where you say, I'm tired of looking at myself.
Well, but you've got to—it's a feedback loop.
Yes, yes.
You've got to get that audience responding to you, or else you're not going to know if it works or not.
Exactly, because if you don't share that moment, and nobody's going to know about it, and you have to. Very important. You've got to share that.
Well, you've got quite the variety of moments coming up at this.
Yep, I'm very looking forward to it very much. As you mentioned before, we got a variety of performing arts, and having the variety is, to me, is very exciting.
It sounds exciting, Lisa. Great to talk to you this morning.
Thank you so much.
Misa Tupou is the organizer of the third annual Oahu Fringe Festival, runs November 7th through 10th in Honolulu's Chinatown, and details can be found at hpr2.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the interactive exhibition Now Hear This, connecting music and art at Spalding House in Makiki Heights through January 5th. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week we talked to writer and chef David Tanis about something he's quite passionate about, home cooking.
Things begin to unravel when people don't cook at home.
We talk about preservation of vineyards and learn how to quiet down and cook slowly. Join us. That's The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Saturday morning at 9, following Weekend Edition.
You may have noticed a shift recently. State policymakers turned their attention to connecting the Oahu and Maui electric grids, and that would likely supplant the long-debated industrial-scale wind farm proposed for Lanai. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair now joins us with today's reality check. Hi, Chad.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, likely both projects are not going to be pursued at the same time because that just sort of doesn't make sense, and there's just a limited amount of attention and resources, right?
That's right, and that's coming from Mark Glick. He heads the State Energy Office. You just don't want to try and hook everything up. And so, I mean, really one of the main reasons is you don't need the wind energy from Lanai to help Oahu via an undersea cable. It's just not essential to the state meeting its renewable energy goals. So if Lanai is taken out of the equation, the focus would be Maui to Oahu, excuse me, Maui to Oahu. And remember this as well, as you indicated, both are electric grids. You know, if you hook up Lanai, basically it's hooking up an extension cord. So that is the focus of the state right now, to get that undersea cable between the two islands.
Well, I mean, obviously the folks on Lanai are not just breathing a sigh of relief, but they're saying, we told you so.
Well, there certainly, as you know, been a lot of controversy about whether windmills should go up on that island, even though Larry Ellison is focused on renewable energy. It's been a very controversial issue. Think about what happened on Molokai. I mean, essentially, that portion of the project has fallen apart, largely because of community protest, not wanting the visual blight, not wanting to interfere with lands where people are hunting and so forth. And frankly,
there was a philosophical argument, right?
Exactly. Why should the smaller islands of Lanai and Molokai help divert their energy to the gathering place, the overpopulated, if you will, not overpopulated yet, but pretty crowded Oahu? So these are important arguments that a lot of folks in our community have.
They also made an argument which continues to resurge, which is that Oahu should be meeting its own needs and not relying on somebody else to help with that in any way.
That's a very good point. And we spoke to an official on Maui working for Mayor Arakawa there, saying, you know, he thinks a lot of folks on Maui would be open to the idea, but that is the concern, that Oahu should basically, if you will, carry its own load when it comes to energy. You don't want to get a situation where Maui is basically supporting Oahu in meeting its energy goals. So that's something that's going to have to be worked out.
So what does Doug McLeod say, the Maui Energy Commissioner?
That's Doug that is actually saying that, and he's cautious about this whole thing. He's saying, let's go through this carefully. There are some concerns as to whether energy costs will actually be realized. Remember, this thing's going to cost $700 million, but supposedly over its lifetime, it will basically pay for itself.
Well, yeah.
If things go as expected.
Right. And we kind of saw some of that argument fall apart when we saw Oahu rates rise as we were sort of making up the difference and trying to pay for it over time. So the bottom line is we really don't know yet.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, more
you got it right, Beth Ann.
And you too. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye-bye.
Chad Blair is a political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, it seems as if new mobile apps are popping up all the time, yeah?
Well, you know, everybody's got a smartphone, and they're just proliferating all over the place. And more so than ever, businesses and other types of brands want to get, you know, their sort of application out there. And there's this just this demand for programmers. So I think our show this afternoon is going to be about what kinds of resources are being offered here in our sort of programming community to get people up to speed on being able to program something for a mobile app. And, you know, I think it's, you know, it's interesting because you would think, well, maybe colleges would be prepping students for this kind of marketplace. But this marketplace changes so quickly.
You know, I have to wonder.
You think you got it after you graduate and got your degree, but you know, the software industry for, you know, mobile app programming has already changed.
I would wonder, Bert, if it wouldn't at some point reach saturation. You know, just about the time you got your degree, that there wouldn't be any demand anymore. There has to be a finite number of these that people really want. Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know. I can't predict, you know, what the curve for, you know, the supply and demand for programmers. But if you look at a company like Google, which is really kind of built all around the capability of developing applications, whether it's for, you know, the web or search or doing, you know, some kind of novel way of monetizing advertising, you know, there's all kinds of applications. So it's not just mobile apps. It's, you know, I think any company needs to know how do they be competitive on the web.
Well, thanks a lot for that, Bert, and we'll look forward to that tonight at 5 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra Masterwork Series, Tito Munoz conducting, presenting Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 with soloist Cecile Licod, 4 p.m. this Sunday at the Blaisdell, hawaiisymphonyorchestra.org.
Okay, tonight, Hawaii's real fashionistas will don their best to see who in the state's designer community is judged the best at the Governor's Fashion Awards. The event caps the inaugural state-supported Fashion Month. Looking forward, we wondered what's next for the industry. And early this morning, we called Georgia Skinner, the chief officer of the State of Hawaii's Creative Industries Division in the Department of Economic Development and Tourism, and we asked her what she sees.
The Hawaii Fashion Month, this inaugural year, really galvanized the community and showed us the value of this entire creative cluster, this ecosystem of not only our designers, but all the elements of the people that go along with designing garments, accessories, and all those things that are part of the fashion industry. You know, it's a globally billion-dollar industry, I think, probably next to entertainment, probably the most lucrative, industry out there. And Hawaii has had a great legacy of design. And what was wonderful to see was the legacy companies coming together to help emerging designers and the whole community looking at how can we make this a more vibrant economic activity for the state and how can we launch more designers globally. For me and for creative industries, for our BDSD division and DBED in general, we were really impressed with how the community came together, and now the community going forward is really driving how they will shape their own future, and the state is there to assist and facilitate that.
So what does that look like as we go forward? Are we going to see a Fashion Month next year?
Well, I think a lot of people are discussing that, and we would love to see that happen. The kinds of people that came in for outfit, for example, opening the doors to our designers and connectivity to people that are on a global level doing great work are now out there talking about Hawaii. So I think it's inevitable. We hope that goes forward. It's up to the industry to kind of you know, rise to that occasion, and I can see that they already are. And I know that the community is discussing all kinds of ways between now and next October to work together to strengthen the community, to look at areas where there are PUCAs, if you will. I mean, we have strengths in designers. We have great programs at the university. Do we have enough sewers in the state? Are there enough people in the pipeline of manufacturing to do a more thriving manufacturing business here? So in addition to the legacy companies that do such a wonderful job, I think they're now looking at partnering and looking at our emerging designers and how we can help the whole ecosystem go forward. You know, it is a potentially billion-dollar industry for the state, and I think not only is it about the numbers, but it's about the impressions and the attraction of the visitor industry, too, to a destination that has a thriving and vibrant fashion.
Looking at what we call designers now, the question is, well, designers of what? Most of it was based in sort of the accessories. Some of it was sort of a glorified cottage industry. There were some who had been long-standing in accessory making, a few designers who actually created full-on collections. We talked to one of them, and she mentioned exactly, you know, what you said a moment ago, that there are some holes in that pipeline, and the big one is really finding people who can help to sew, manufacture, and that those skills have been lost generationally, and we need to find our way back to them. Does that mean we're going to see more of that show up in university classes and in high school classes?
Well, I think you would see that, and definitely the industry is taking the lead through the Hawaii Fashion Incubator. A lot of people were together last night around a table just discussing, you know, this very thing. What is our industry? What does it look like? How can we attract investment to this industry? And more importantly, right now on the ground, where are those areas that we see holes in the pipeline that we can work with the education groups, and also, you know, what can the state do to help even facilitate sourcing people that might already be there? It's just that everyone's working in a cottage way and not in a more collaborative way. So, for example, if there was a collaborative space where designers could go, a Kinko's for designers, if you will, a facility that provided the cutting, address a sewing collective or something. Those kind of things I think the industry is talking about, and we're glad to hear that because it's really important that the industry drive this and the industry is identified, as you've discussed with people at Outfit during the month of October, that there are areas that we can improve on. And I think what I heard is that certainly sewers and other people on the business side to really bring in that understanding of why marketing, packaging yourself, intellectual property, to be sure that you understand merchandising, how to protect your intellectual property. All of those things are important that a designer needs today. So it's not just about designing the clothes. There are wonderful jobs in the production pipeline. Perhaps we need to also focus on that right now.
There are a couple of legacy organizations. I'm thinking about, you know, Iolani and JAM, certainly that's going to be honored tonight. And they've managed to do it, but they're still dealing with an aging workforce, too.
Correct.
So this is not just a problem for new and emerging designers. It's a problem for everybody.
It's a problem for the industry in general, yes. And I think that is one of the key things that needs to be focused on, both at the university level, as well as how do we assimilate. If there are other people that are working here, perhaps they are in a home situation, or they're working part-time somewhere, they're retired from another job, but they're a tremendous talent at sewing. How can we gather those people and make them available not only to the legacy companies, but to the whole fashion cluster in general?
And that seems to be a little bit of a different idea than this notion that somehow we're going to have a whole new focus in schools on how to sew. I mean, that may happen too, but the point is that there are pockets of this kind of talent out there. How do you corral them and how do you leverage that? Particularly, when you have a group that may not look at learning how to be a seamstress as something that's particularly attractive. I mean, especially given the fact that, we have a whole different world now than we did way back when, and the lure of technology and the lure of high salaries may not necessarily be consistent with what we may need to see to be able to create some manufacturing, even at a smaller level.
Yeah, I think I draw a correlation to this to the film industry, and here's why. Because everybody wants to be a director in the film industry, right? But in order to make a film, you need to have a grip, a cable puller, an assistant camera operator, assistant sound guy, a prop guy, somebody that is a gopher that runs and gets all of the things that you need to put on that production. It's the same thing with fashion. If you're a designer, there are so many other opportunities in the production pipeline, and I think, you know, it's really important to encourage the creative part of people that want to be designers. But I think that there's all these other elements in the production pipeline that are just as important. And there's new technologies today in cutting and pattern making, all kinds of CAD designs and very, you know, that translate into the fashion world and the design world that are important for producing and manufacturing more than, you know, one-offs or 10 pieces in a collection. Once you go to a trade show from Hawaii, for example, our sister agency run by Dennis Ling, you know, they have taken for 3 years designers to Japan. If you get a large order in Japan and you can't come back and fulfill that order, that's a problem. So we have to focus on this area, and I think you're right, Bethann. Maybe in general people think it's not that exciting to learn that skill, but you'd be surprised. There's so much creativity in sewing, so much technical expertise.
And it keeps you really employable with a great deal of security and stability.
Exactly. And I think Hawaii has enormous potential to, you know, rise to its own level. We don't need to be New York, because we're not going to be New York. We have something totally unique in Hawaii that if we harness it the right way, we can really make this an economic driver for our state.
Georgia Skinner, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great to talk to you, and congratulations on your pledge drive.
Thank you very much. Georgia Skinner is Chief Officer of the State of Hawaii's Creative Industries Division in the Department of Economic Development and Tourism. She's a former Film and State Foundation on Culture and the Arts Commissioner, an author and producer. Tonight's Fashion Month ends with the Governor's Fashion Awards, and more about it is on HPR2.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm Jeff Hamilton from the Clayton Hamilton Jazz Orchestra and the Jeff Hamilton Trio. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at HPR2.org.
Early this morning, we brought you back in time to a dark moment in Hawaiian history. We often don't venture into the macabre, but on the day before Halloween, well, we thought maybe it's only fitting. And that's why we focused on the Battle of Nuuanu. Waged at the site of the modern-day Pali Lookout, the battle was the last major and bloody conflict before all of Hawaii was united under Kamehameha the Great. Some 300 Oahu warriors were forced to choose between diving off the cliffs of the Pali to a certain doom, or being wiped out by Kamehameha's forces. For our quiz today, we asked if you could tell us what month and year the event occurred. The answer is May 1795. And since then, some paranormal activity in the area is said to happen. You can judge for yourself. But that's our pre-Halloween backyard quiz. It's now 8:47, and if you'd like to be in touch, you can. Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. We'll be right back.
Kalo, or taro, the staple food of the Pacific, is something far more than a nutrition source. It's at the heart of a way of life that dates back centuries, seen as a life-giving ancestor, and an understanding of its role in Hawaiian life is essential to understanding the culture. Kamuela Vance is the director of a documentary, Kalo Culture, that looks at the effort to keep a tradition and a cultural heritage alive in the modern world, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Kamuela.
Good morning. Aloha.
What made you want to make this film in the first place?
Well, I've always been interested in the medium of film, but I also like poetry, art, you know, mm-hmm. diversity of the arts and culture. And growing up on a ranch, you know, I'm really tied to the land here, to the Aina.
Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up?
I was born here on Oahu. Uh-huh. And when I was 8 years old, I moved to Maui, upcountry Maui, Makawao, Maui. Uh-huh. We had a ranch. I rodeoed. I played polo.
Uh-huh.
So I think...
Country Hawaii,
yes,
life.
Yeah, you know. So I guess that's like deep-rooted in me, you know, tied sure. to the land, the old ways. You know, I grew up around the elders, and I learned from them. And at this day and age, with things changing, I think it's really important to video and document the people who are living the old ways.
Before they're gone.
Yes,
right?
And perpetuate it, you
sure.
know. And keep put it in film so people can remember, you know. After I'm gone, it'll still be here.
Yeah.
And hopefully this will inspire people to get out there and to keep doing what their ancestors did to perpetuate that lifestyle.
You know, when we look back at history, I often find myself wishing that means had been available at earlier periods in history. I mean, how much we could have gotten out of that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's why I made this film. I'm friends with Daniel Anthony mm-hmm. of Mana'ai, the Pa'i'ai.
Uh-huh.
I think he's the forerunner in the boom of Kalo taking off now.
And there is one.
Yes, there is one, mm-hmm. definitely. So he and I have been friends for a few years, and I had this idea to do a film with him and fusing poetry and music together with other mediums that I like.
Mm-hmm.
So Kalo Culture follows Daniel Anthony over 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, leading up to the Kalo Festival,
mm-hmm.
which was at Haleiwa back then,
right.
in 2010. And his daily life. I stayed with Daniel for 3 days. I took my camera equipment and I stayed with him Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And whenever mm-hmm. I saw something taking place that I thought would be interesting and needed to be put on film.
That's how you do it,
yeah,
right?
I turned my camera on. I had 9 hours of footage. My film is 1 hour. I had 9 hours of film
yeah.
over 3 days to edit, put together a 1 hour documentary. And I think I pulled it off pretty good. I think I did a good job, you know?
Well, good. You know, a lot of, when you shoot documentary, a lot of times events unfold before your camera that tell your story for you.
Yes.
Is that what happened for
yes.
you?
Yes, yes, definitely.
It's great when that happens.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. You know, I watch a lot of films. You know,
uh-huh.
that I love film. I watch all kinds of film, French, New Wave films, Japanese films.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this film called Grey Gardens.
Sure.
The Mazo brothers. They
yep.
also did one called...
They're pioneers.
Yes, definitely.
Great pioneers.
And that's the kind of documentary film style I like. They're my inspiration. You know, I've seen a lot of their movies, and they show reality.
Yeah.
You know, it's reality. It's nothing is contrived or convoluted. I didn't, you know, I was tired of the same old documentaries. You know, have a seat in the chair. Here, let me turn the camera on and ask you a bunch of questions.
You know, a lot of documentarians have started to question the objectivity of the form,
yeah.
right? Because as soon as you add music, as soon as you add narration, you've
right.
made it subjective.
Definitely.
That's why, you know, the other Maisel's brothers are pioneers,
yes.
D.A. Pennebaker
yes.
and Frederick Wiseman,
yeah.
who does his documentaries without any narration
yeah.
or any music because of that sense of artificiality. Do you have that feeling that it would be easy for you to manipulate events if
definitely,
you wanted to?
Definitely. If I wanted to, you know, that it's with film, it's easy to do that.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. You see commercials all the time, you know, people trying to sell you something, you know, that's what commercials do.
And it's a very good tool of manipulation.
Yes, 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 it is.
So how do you resist that is my question, Kamala.
I try to stay true to myself, you know? I want to capture the moment, the feeling. I want people to feel what I'm feeling as the story's unfolding. So I want to convey that. I want to capture that moment in time, that feeling of what's taking place.
But getting them to feel what you're feeling has to be accomplished for a documentarian without telling them what to feel.
Definitely.
That's the trick.
Yeah, yeah. And I try to do that with my camera work, you know? I think if like Orson Welles said, if you're a bit of a director, if you're a bit of a producer, a bit of an editor, a bit of an actor, then you bring something special because you know what should be conveyed. So if you have those qualities and you have the camera's in the hand of a poet.
Yeah.
And with your camera angles, your zooms, the music you add into, you can convey a certain message. Like silent film. That's why I love silent film.
Yeah.
Because you can just sit there and watch it. And without any words, without any music, you can see what's going on. I can take Sergio Leone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, put it on the TV and turn the volume off and just sit there and watch it, and I know what's going on.
Or Buster Keaton or Chaplin.
Or Buster Keaton. Now, those are good films.
You bet they are.
Because you don't need an audio track. You don't need music. You can just sit there and watch it, and you know what's going on.
And you know, part of that is art. That's trusting the medium, too.
Yes, definitely.
That's a big part of that. Interesting that you mentioned Orson Welles because, you know, along with his fiction films, he did documentaries.
Yes.
And he made no attempt to have them be objective documentaries.
Yeah. He made a good one called Fake.
Yeah.
Where he manipulated.
F for Fake.
F for Fake, where he manipulated the audience. And at the end, I don't want to give it away. But exactly.
I'll give it away. He says, I just manipulated.
Exactly, you know. So, you know, that tells the story right there about film and how important it is. So I think, you know, filmmakers should, you know, be aware of that, you know, because people can tell, you know, you can fool the eye, but you can't fool the heart. You can't fool what people feel, you know.
Kamala, that's very well said. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks very much.
Kamala Vance is the director of Kahlo Culture, which will be shown November 10th and 12th at Honolulu's Doris Duke Theater at the Honolulu Museum of Art. You can learn more at hpr2.org.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Jean Houston, author of The Wizard of Us. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about transformational lessons from Oz. Please join me.
Sunday morning at 11.
We started today, Chris, talking about the complexity of an issue that goes over decades, really, the gridlock that we have in government and what looks like it's going to continue. We kind of ended with the idea about the complexity of being simple when you're trying to tell one message. Maybe somebody needs to link one with the other.
I think so. And also about the way in which, how difficult it is to truly be an objective chronicler. How as soon as some information flows through you, through your camera, your voice, the way you write it, it becomes a little subjective. It's something that anybody telling a story has to be watchful about.
And knowing that it's going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
Whether you're knowing that it's happening, or whether you're not cognizant of that fact, it's going to happen because you're human.
Yeah, and no sense pretending to be an entirely objective source. You know, the trick is to admit where your subjectivity rears itself.
If you can. Sometimes it's going to happen, and you're not going to know either, but that's part of it, that we all know that we are human, and that's just part of the gig.
Indeed.
Part of our gig is to say goodbye for the moment, but we will be back tomorrow in part to talk about the implications of the right to refuse service argument in the marriage equality debate.
And coming to grips with the history that we don't want to relive.
You've got a conversation the rest of us should hear? Well, talk back to your radio. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation, or just tell me at BecauseHPR.
Hear today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information on the HPR2 website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich, and we'll meet you back here tomorrow morning for more of The Conversation.